Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on whatever time zone you're joining us from. And welcome to today's webinar, BRCGS Food Safety Issue 9, What's New? My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team here at the Perry Johnson Companies, and I'll be helping to facilitate today's webinar and offer technical support to our speakers. Today, we are welcoming Richa Betty-Navik of BRCGS. She'll be introduced to you momentarily. We also have with us Terry Baboyich, the president of PJFSI, as well as a couple members of our UK and US teams for FSI. And we'll be saying a few words of introduction just before the meat of the webinar gets started. But now, without further ado, I wanted to go ahead and introduce Terry Baboyich, the president of PJFSI. He has a few words he'd like to say to you. So, Terry, go ahead and take it away whenever you're ready.
Well, Happy New Year, everyone. And Amy, thank you so much for being the moderator for today. And welcome, everybody. Some of you may or may not know about who we are as an organization. I'm coming to you from actually Troy, Michigan. And we're glad to be able to have a good list of speakers today. And Richa, I wanna thank you so much on behalf of myself and our team. She's gonna be the presenter today, and she's directly with BRC in the UK. Very knowledgeable, and I think you're really gonna enjoy your presentation. So Richa, thank you so much. Our organization is an international organization. We've been in business for about 30 years, and early on we started up with ISO 9000 when ISO really came to the United States back in the days with automotive and aerospace that really promulgated all the international standards. And from there we grew heavily into food safety. We've got offices all over the globe, and one of the things, we are a privately held company. And one of the things that you're going to find out of all the certification bodies throughout the world, we are different. And we are the number one certification body in the United States for the ISO standards. And that's out of about 100 certification bodies that operate here. And why we're large is because of the way we operate. We're privately held. We can act quickly. We're very customer oriented. We're not bureaucratic. We're normal people. We answer questions that have to be answered. We have a switchboard with people that actually answer the phones and not a voicemail. And we've been told that our turnaround times and reaction are better than anything in the industry. And I'm really proud of that. And I'm proud to be with the company for over 27 years with long-term leadership team that we have here. And without any further ado, I'm going to talk about a couple of people that are very important on our team. I'm going to introduce them. They can say hello, say who you are. And first of all, Chris Reno is the one that organized this particular event with Richa. Chris, why don't you say hi and introduce yourself to the team?
Yeah, hey, good afternoon or good morning, depending on what time zone you're in. My name is Chris Reno. I'm a commercial business manager here in the U.S. and, really happy to be a part of this today. I've actually seen the presentation, and I think it's going to cover a lot of the questions that you may have. However, like Amy mentioned in the beginning, please put any questions in the chat box or question box, and we'll make sure to get to those at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Also, we have some boots on the ground in the United Kingdom. Our offices that we have locally, our representatives are in Manchester. I'd like to introduce Tom. Tom, are you there to say hello to the team?
Hi, good afternoon all. Hope this finds you well. Hope you're nice and warm with this weather. Most definitely in the UK. I think it's really important just to let you know that we are a massive international company, but more importantly, we've got boots on the ground in the UK. My name's Tom Wheaton, I head up the team here, so I'm the site manager within the UK. So by all means, time zones may be one thing, but if you are based in the UK on this webinar, you'll have direct contact and a real time zone with ourselves. So yeah, thanks for the introduction, Terry, and I hope to speak to you all soon.
Thank you, Tom. Also, from administrative support level, we have Tracy. Tracy, would you like to say hello to the team?
Yes, hello everybody. My name's Tracy. I'm the administration support based in Stoke-on-Trent for the UK team of BRC.
Thank you, Tracy. And also, last but not least, we have one of our key BRC auditors, Dr. Rosalie. Are you there and available to say hello to the team?
We have Rosalie on as an attendee, so unfortunately she's not able to speak, Terry.
No worries. Okay, very good. Without any further ado, let's go ahead and get things started. Amy and Richa, the stage is yours. And thanks again, everybody.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Terry, for introducing the team in the US and the UK. And as you can see on her webcam now, we do have with us Richa Bedinovic. I'm so happy to have her on. Richa is the technical expert and senior standards manager for the Global Standard for Food Safety and START at BRCGS, where she's responsible for developing and maintaining the value and growth of both programs globally. She previously managed the storage and distribution standard. Richa completed her master's in food technology and quality assurance from the University of Reading in the UK. During her 13-year career, Richa has worked in a variety of roles associated with food safety and quality management, including food manufacturing, the food service and retail sector, as well as the logistics industry. She's passionate about finding ways to successfully make sector issues tangible for a wide variety of standard users, facilitating better understanding and developing guidance on related themes to support the industry. Richa, thank you again so much for taking the time to join us and preparing this presentation for us. I'm going to hand control of the slides over to you. And if you want to unmute yourself and you can take it away.
Perfect. Thank you so much for the introduction, Terry and Amy, and thanks for having me here to do the session today. Before I begin, I'm just going to go off camera because it can be a bit distracting sometimes. Okay, so welcome everyone. And the intention with this session today, as it might be clear from the introduction to, the webinar, is to take you through what the key changes have been to Food Safety Issue 9. So Food Safety Issue 9 launched last year, and we are coming up to the first audits against the standard. And it's very nice format and the forum today just to review what the key changes have been. And as already indicated, please type your questions in the chat, and hopefully we will try to cover them during the session. If not, there will be a follow-up. Considering we've done similar sessions previously, what the intention would be for me to try and cover any frequently asked questions that we have come up in regards to these specific topics within the standard up until now. So if there's anything else that we are unable to cover, as I said, please do type them in the chat. So to begin with, let's look at the food standard status review. So currently it is issue 8 that is live. What we have within issue 8 is 22,000 plus certificated sites going up to 23,000. Roughly, the standard still sees a very nice heavy growth within the global regions at 5.3%. We have presence in 126 countries, with the top countries being Italy, UK, closely followed by China. And their number of CBEs does keep to vary a little bit. As you can see on the screen, it's 74. It can go up and down, but our entire CB pool and the approved certification bodies, the database is maintained on our BRCGS directory that the entire public sort of, it's publicly available, so you can go and have a look at the approved certification body list. So timeline wise, as I already indicated, so standard was published along with the guidance. So guidance the intention interpretation guideline, as well as the key changes, was published in August. We have been conducting courses. So essentially, considering I led on the Food Issue 9 project, we did the principal trainer ourselves, and the principal trainers have been training the ATPs, and now ATPs are imparting the same training and the same content to auditors and site training courses. Now, as I've already said, we are approaching the deadline for Food Safety Issue 9 standards. So the first audits against this iteration would commence from 1st of February 2023. So looking at some of the key influences, how did we go about developing Issue 9? So the very first thing to iterate is, as you must have seen, Food Safety Issue 9 is not a standard of revolution. It is a standard of evolution. So there's been a revamp on quite a few themes. Certain topics have been strengthened, and the influences and how did we go about them. So to begin with, as we know, Culture has been a topic of discussion for a long time. We will cover culture in a little bit more detail during the session, but what we've done with issue 9 is provide further clarity on product safety culture, and we have strengthened this area. The working group wanted the behaviors as a term to be included within the requirements. How have we gone about including them within the clause, and how would that be audited is what we'll look at in a second. Additionally, as you might know, while we were developing issue 9, there was the update to Codex. The Codex 2020 was published. Now, we had to ensure all the requirements of Codex are incorporated into the standard. Hence, what you would find is Section 2 was updated accordingly. There's quite a few changes, and but once you go through issue 9, you would have a Codex compliant HACCP essentially. The next influence came from the audit options. So as the area of COVID essentially, can say has passed mostly, but it's still passing. But during that time, we developed some additional audit options, namely remote audits, blended audits. And the blended audits were adopted by the industry. GFSI considered them, so they are included and covered within the benchmark. Hence, the blended audit option and any learning from the remote audits has been taken into the issue 9 updates. And that's how the audit options have been expanded in within the protocol. Additionally, there's enhancement to core product safety activities. We'll cover and look at them in a little bit more detail. And there's further clarity that has been provided by sites. Now, sometimes this comes from influences such as GFSI benchmarks. So as you can see, animal primary conversion, animal feed, the update to the standard is a result of some of the requirements that we have to consider as a part of the GFSI benchmark. Another key influence, and as an organization, we have quite a few audits and non-conformances that do get submitted at the end of the audit. All the non-conformance data is captured on our BRCGS directory, and CBs submit the audit reports. Now, there's a lot of information. There's 190,000, if we can say, non-conformances that essentially we have to assess when it comes to your annual NC data. So there's a plethora of data out there. As a part of the update process, we do go and review the non-conformances on a regular basis. What you see in front of your screen are the top 10 non-conformances that came out of issue 8. So while we were in the process of updating issue 9, these top 10 non-conformances were put out to the working group, and looking at some of them, what you would notice is, so as an organization, we are quite passionate about trying to support the industry with guidance documents, and hence there's quite a bit of update going to various guidance documents, topics, webinars, and however we can support the industry to upgrade their product safety practices. Now, looking at these non-conformances, there wasn't really anything that essentially we could do in addition to what we already do not have in place. And hence, the fundamentals that exist at a site, for example, your internal audits, your validation verification, or root cause analysis, none of these are something that are new to the site. But if they are enhanced, if they are conducted and done in the way that they should be, most of these non-conformances wouldn't actually drop down the list, or possibly one day, this is our hope, one day we might be able to get rid of them and not see them. So if you look at the top two or three in itself, so premises and equipment hygiene, the issues that we were seeing, dirty premises, maybe certain areas not cleaned, equipment, there was some buildup of dust essentially. So these are the type of non-conformances that we see there. Doors, internal, external. What you usually find in the NCs is either the doors were not closed as the site processes indicated. So it's not something that the standard reiterated, but it's what the site decided for themselves, but they're not really following their own protocols, their own procedures. Or it could be holes around the doors when the auditors have gone around, or damaged doors. So again, as I said, that these are site processes that they are not following. And there's a number of mechanisms that you already have in place, internal audits, would pick these up if an internal audit is done correctly. So essentially, how do we go out supporting the industry by looking at this NC and trying to develop some further information, some further guidance? Similarly, with equipment construction and maintenance, there was damage to the equipment not really meeting the hygienic design, and so on. So if you go down the list, you will see very similarly how many of these non-conformances would not really occur in case the fundamentals that exist within the industry were followed. So as I was saying, the influences have been, some of these sections, they have been strengthened within issue 8, from issue 8 to issue 9, so internal audits, root cause analysis, validation, verification, risk assessment, incident management, and traceability. Your core fundamental concepts, there's a lot more focus on strengthening these within issue 9. So just a summary of what would we be talking about during the session today, some of the key changes to the requirements, the most significant ones, and we'll cover them in a lot more detail. And similarly, the key changes to the protocol, blended audits being one, and the other changes around the introduction of the mandatory unannounced audit every 3 years. So, starting off with the key changes to the requirement, as I'd already indicated, when it comes to food safety and quality culture, this has been a topic of discussion for quite a few years. And as you might know, with issue 8, we were the first ones to introduce culture clause within GFSI benchmark standard. And what we've seen is the clause itself and the NCs around this clause have evolved, where in the first year, what we noticed is sites, they didn't really understand the difference between having your site objectives and KPIs against a food safety culture plan, because they were just presenting that to the auditors in the first instance, thinking, oh, we do monitor our quality objectives, potentially that's what goes into your quality culture. So from that onwards in year two, because the requirement of having implemented the entire plan and the review mechanism came in. So what the auditors were finding is, okay, site did have a separate plan, but the review frequency either wasn't correct or the site had not really done anything. And year three, we did find gaps within continuous improvement elements. So that was how culture has evolved. But we would definitely say that the sites are, they have understood how having a culture plan in place can have a positive impact on your food safety practices. However, what the working group wanted is, considering behavior is a term that does crop up in a number of definitions within culture, that be GFSI's definition or various other definitions of culture that exist within the industry. So behavior is a key consideration. So the task that we had as an organization is to build behaviors into the clause. And that's how you would see that the clause has evolved. We'll look at the clause in a second. So where previously it was very high level and issue 8 just had the statement of having a clear plan established for product safety culture, the two additional elements that had a strong influence, one was the statement on the plan shall include measures to achieve positive culture change. So that is the first continuous improvement element that was built in. And the second big change is around defining the activities. So from a GFSI benchmark point of view, we had to define four of the bullet points that sit under bullet point one. So your communication, training, feedback to employees, and performance measurement. However, behavior did come in into these bullet points. So the way to look at these behaviors, it could be something very generic, something that your site managers, supervisors that work in your area, they might be aware of as a behavior, a food safety related behavior to stress. So any behavior that may have an impact or help improve product safety practices that the supervisors are aware of. The common examples that I take are hand washing or protective clothing changes. So in case you know or you're fully confident as a site that hand washing as an activity is not really completed at the frequency at which it is intended or when no one's watching, if you are not fully comfortable with that behavior being followed through, then potentially that can get added to your plan, or similarly, any other behaviors that might help improve these product safety practices. That goes into your plan. The intention with this entire clause does not change. The auditor is not coming in with an intention to audit the behaviors. They are coming in with an intention to audit the plan. However, as a part of the culture clause, as you can see, it's dual color coded. So the auditor would be looking at how the site, the behaviors that have been identified within the plan. So how are the star site adhering to it, and all the actions that have been identified by the sites, they are being taken, and the review plan effectiveness definitely comes in. And the auditor, as I said, would not be there just to mark you down on certain other behaviors that you as a site are not really considering. However, with the holistic picture, in case that is having a derogatory impact on your product safety practices, potentially could have an influence on certain other sections of the standard. But they're not there to mark you down on behaviors. They would be auditing the plan as such. So moving on to HACCP. As I'd already indicated, so Codex updates came about. And as a result, there was influence to a number of clauses within the HACCP section. One thing to definitely highlight to the entire group here, we do have a number of inquiries that come in, and quite a few sites that do question the terminology differences that exist regionally. So in case, for example, US, we do know the terminology used in that region is very different to potentially what our standard requires. You do not really need to have multiple plans with an intention to cover these terminology differences. If you have a plan that is compliant with Section 2 of the standard but uses different terminology, don't worry about it. The auditors in the region, they are fully versed and very well aware of what the terminology means, and they would take that into consideration. However, do have multiple plans if your operation requires it, but not just to take that terminology differences into consideration. So there's quite a few changes within this section, but the key ones to highlight are in regards to review of the HACCP plan. So what you would see is reviewing of the plan, where it used to be a separate section for issue weight, that was 2.14, that's been taken out. And now the requirements to review the HACCP plan have been merged into section 2.12. There is the requirement to validate your entire HACCP plan in addition to the verification procedures. So where you have your normal validation of different process steps. So in case there's a new process that gets added in, Codex has expanded this requirement, and you would need to validate your entire HACCP plan in entirety. How you go about that? If you have an existing HACCP plan, potentially the requirements in 2.12.2 and 2.12.3 would help you with the validation processes. But if you have these existing studies that were done years ago, it might be the time to pull them all out, put them all together, because it will help you with the validation of your existing plans. However, on the contrary, if you have a new HACCP plan that needs validating, it might be fairly easier as an operation, because you might be doing these validation for your different steps, and all that information would build in and count towards the validation of your entire plan. But something that we're trying to highlight to the sites, please do not get caught out, because this requirement is specifically asking for you to validate your HACCP plans in an entirety. So the next one to highlight is the outsource processing. Someone who has been with the BRCGS standards and has followed it through would know that we have taken several attempts to amend and update outsource processing definition. It wasn't understood very well with issue weight based on all the feedback, all the inquiries that we got. Hence, the working group has taken another stab at it. We have revised the definition. Along with the revision, there's quite a few new clauses that have been added into this section. Statement of intent has been updated to provide that clarity. And there's, as I said, quite a few requirements that have gone in. What we would cover in this session is just an explanation, overarching explanation of outsource processes. So essentially what we said for issue weight was, if a product it starts at the site, it goes off to a different site, it returns back to the site and you do some further packing and processing on it, then that falls into the definition of outsourced processing. With issue 9, we have expanded that definition a bit further. And in addition to packing and processing, we are allowing storage as well. So in case the product goes off site, comes back to site, the main certificated site is what we mean here. And you do some further packing, processing, or storage activities, then that is covered under outsourced processing. But if the product goes off site, does not return, that's outside the scope. If the entire operation is happening at a different site, potentially it's again out of scope, and that operation might need to take their own certification, or it could sit under the definition of traded products. And just to sum up that and put it in some sort of perspective against traded products. So your raw material intake happens on site, your site processes, something happens to it, including your raw material acceptance. You complete that process and then it goes off site, comes back. There's additional packing, processing, or storage. That's outsourced processing. However, if a site is purchasing product with an intention to sell it further and there's no further activity on it, then it sits in within the definition of traded products. As I've alluded to, based on the NC analysis, root cause analysis is a topic that's very close to our heart, along with the internal audits. So again, these are some core key fundamental tools that the site has. If utilized correctly, they are invaluable. And for that to happen, what we have done as a group, with the working group essentially, we have gone and we looked at how root cause analysis was referenced within the standard. Those references have been updated, clauses have been reviewed, but what you would again notice is there's better linkages throughout these clauses and to other sections, and again with the intention of continuous improvement. Now, going into the detail of RCA, because I'm sure being a GFCI benchmark standard and you guys as the industry working with the GFCI benchmark standards, root cause analysis is nothing new, but this is unfortunately still the mentality that comes with RCA. And this is based on the root cause analysis information that gets submitted to us in with the non-conformances on your audit reports, or let it be based on the product recall data that comes in, because that again, site needs to follow up with the root cause analysis, looking at all that data. It's not really being followed through. So the mechanisms you have in place where you should really be going to the root cause, people still tend to stop at a very comfortable position. So not really utilizing the 5Y techniques per se to get to the actual root cause, something which can neatly be accepted by the auditor and the certification bodies, sadly still stays to be the mentality. Again, not really going into what some of these mechanisms and various sort of tools that are out there in the market. The intention is just to stress upon the fact RCA is not really done correctly to the intent that it should. So please do utilize the tools that are out there. Moving on to food defense. So what you might find is with this section, so there's a little bit of a revamp where site security, food defense used to sit together under one section. Site security requirements have been moved up into the external standards and site security, section 4.1, and section 4.2 is wholly and solely food defense now. It's been an integral part of the standards anyways, as well as for sites. The revamp to this section is how the clauses have been structured. So now the clauses, they mirror your food fraud section. So in case a site chooses to consider both these topics together, you want to do your TASIP and RASIP together under as one study. Now, the way the framework is, there would be ease because the clauses are quite reflected, very similar, and there's a similar flow to it as well. One key addition to food fraud section is in regards to training requirement. So what we have indicated is if you have a food defense team, you do need to make sure that they are competent. They do understand the challenges that are associated with the product type that a site handles, and have competence there. Could be in form of external training, could be in form of internal training, would require experience essentially with the product type. So the site needs to understand, very similar to having a HACCP team and understanding their competence for their input into HACCP plan, a food defense team would need to have that competence in place as well. I think I've clicked too quickly. I do apologize for that. So moving on to equipment section. What one may notice is there, this section is one of the ones that has undergone the most significant change within Issue 9. So there are several standard guidelines and industry guidelines that were updated around the same time while we were working on Issue 9 updates. And what we've done is taken those industry best practice guidelines, and the section has been aligned and updated accordingly. There's quite a few amends, so the entire section has been restructured, rewritten. Essentially, there's new requirements for the new equipment on to this site, so let it be brand new equipment or secondhand and refurbished equipment, and plus there's quite a few other clauses that have been added in to consider static equipment, mobile equipment, and your battery charging, essentially. So equipment design and suitability is how the hygienic design considerations have been built in into Issue 9. As I was saying, that new equipment is not just new that you buy brand new to a site. If you are talking about refurbished, that will be new to site. Hence, the requirements would be applicable to those. Similarly, secondhand equipment, or if you are buying equipment that's on lease for a very long time, all this equipment categories will fall in within the standard considerations, and this section on equipment would be applicable to them. One key consideration to highlight here is please do consider the risk proportionality to the equipment type and the commissioning and installation of equipment that happens at the site. So for example, in case a site is trying to install something, or maybe you've bought a new food scoop and you are trying to install that food scoop in within your process, your operational, your site operation. Now the risk associated with installing something like a food scoop is very minimal or limited compared to a massive conveyor belt, which comes in but then not lots of nuts and bolts, various areas that the site needs to clean, consider. There's quite a few nooks and crevices that would need to be considered as a part of maintenance, your hygiene, your cleaning requirements. So be aware of the risk that the equipment poses and what sort of installation requirements may need to go in and the sign-offs associated with various departments. Again, one other thing to bear in mind is the linkage with some of the other sections. So equipment in itself doesn't have a massive consideration from the other sections of the standard, as cleaning, as maintenance. So all these considerations do need to be considered while you are developing your processes and procedures around your equipment installation. Having one procedure potentially one size would not fit all. So there's all these considerations that do need to be built in. Procedures need to be there in place for the auditors to assess. You may or may not be following all the processes at the same time, but they all need to be considered and developed accordingly. Moving on to animal primary conversion. So as I've indicated, this requirement or the change to this section has come about from GFSI benchmark requirements. This is a new section to the standard. Animal primary conversion by definition is slaughter, evacuation of animals, or slaughter and gutting of fish. So essentially, if you are operating in category 1 and 2 is where you might need to consider the animal primary conversion section. There's very specific controls that we do talk about within this section, and the way it works, there's new requirements around traceability that have come in. And in case you are trying to save or use different parts of the animal, and if you are planning to keep them and utilize them for a different mechanism, for a different operation, then you do need to take care of those parts, essentially, is what the intention there is. As I said, it's not really applicable to every category. It's just most likely category 1, 2, and 4 that this section would be applicable to. And considering the time, the limited time we have, we won't be able to cover all the key changes to issue 9. However, there is the key changes document that's available on BRCGS participate website and on the store, if you would like to go and have a look, and that details every single change that has happened from issue 8 to issue 9. Moving on to the key changes to protocol. So as I said, the main one that the industry essentially is still trying to wrap their heads around is something that was introduced by the GFSI benchmark itself. So it's not a BRCGS requirement. Any GFSI benchmark standard would need to undertake this. So the idea behind the update is that any site that is within the announced program for the standard would need to undertake at least one unannounced audit in a 3-year period. So the period essentially has started. So do expect, if you are within the announced audit program, do expect to have an unannounced audit at some point from now up until the next 3 years. And the other change was to blended announced audits. So as I said, as a result of the options that we made available to the industry during the COVID era, we did keep the blended announced audit within the protocol. It is available for issue 8 and now is incorporated into issue 9. This is a GFSI benchmark protocol, essentially. So you would have accredited certificates. The way it works is you have your audit that's split into two parts. You have the remote element followed by the on-site element. And sites that do opt in into the blended announced audit would still need to undertake the mandatory 1 and 3 unannounced audit. However, we do not have a blended unannounced protocol worked out. Hence, what it means is you can have 2 blended audits that do happen at a site, but when it comes to your unannounced audit, it will be a fully unannounced audit on site. There's no blended unannounced audit protocol. So just what I've said to reiterate, announced has 2 options. You have a full announced audit, or you have within that we do cover the mandatory one unannounced audit every 3 years, or the blended announced audit where you have the remote or on-site, this still has the mandatory 1 and 3 requirement. And then within unannounced program, we only have the fully unannounced audit option. We do not have the blended unannounced option. And before I finish and hand back to Amy, what you see in front of your screen is the list of all the publications that we have done since the launch of issue 9. So as you know, with the food standard, there's a number of guideline documents, a number of publications that do get amended and updated. The bit of color coding that I've done for you on the screen is anything in green is already published and is out there for you to have a look, review. So the standard along with translations, interpretation, guideline, and key changes all published sort of around August. And 1st August was when standard interpretation key changes came in, standard translation. So we have roughly around 11 to 13 translations available. Additionally, we have the additional module on meat supply chain and FSMA that's all updated live for anyone who would like to have a look at that. Then additionally, we have published the guideline on product safety culture, raw meat, raw poultry, allergen management. Now, anything in orange is currently in editorial process, means it will be published and updated and made live very soon, namely the global gap additional module, then understanding high-risk high care, ambient high care. We are renaming this publication and it will be called Understanding Production Risk Zones to align it with the way we've done it in the standard. guideline for fresh produce, product changeover, air quality, and environmental monitoring to follow shortly. And there's a number of other guideline documents, all that are already there within Participate and yet to be updated, but they will follow throughout 2023. For more information on that, please do follow us on social media, or we do even send emails out regularly to communicate these changes. And I think that's where I finish and hand back to Amy.
It is indeed. Thank you, Richa, so much for your presentation. We really do appreciate it. I'm going to put up all the contact information for not only BRCGS, but also the UK and US offices of PDRFSI. So you have Tom, Tracy, and Chris's contact information there. The phone numbers listed will take you directly to the front desk of either office, and then they can direct your call from there. I do see that we had some questions come in from the audience. So let me go ahead and read through some of those so we can get those taken care of. All right, we've got our first question here from Diane. Diane is asking, we lease a small area inside a cold storage warehouse. We blend juice, then place it in storage with our landlord company. Would they be considered an outsourced provider for storage?
Sometimes these inquiries, what I would suggest is, Diane, if you could forward this on to inquiries@brcgs.com, because it might be certain other considerations and a few other questions we might need to ask to provide you with a correct response, whether it be outsourced or not. However, in the first instance, again, you can go to your certification body as well, and they would help you out with responding to this. Unfortunately, as I said, with this, there's more questions than answers that I can provide with this inquiry. So if you wouldn't mind sending it on to inquiries@brcgs.com, and we'll respond to it accordingly.
All right. Thank you, Richa. All right, we've got a question here about animal feed. So the section on animal feed 5.8, does that apply to all the byproducts that are used by animal feed producers, maybe a different site or supplier?
It is a very interesting question. So again, this is something that we have received quite a few number of inquiries on. The way the animal feed works is the extension to the standard was done as a result of a few inquiries that people had raised during issue 8. So sites, they were producing food products, but additionally they did have animal feed that they were producing on site. And what I mean by animal feed is formulating animal feed. So if a site is formulating animal feed and they do undertake all those operations around that, and there's medication and all those consideration and the legislation taken into account, then yes, section on animal feed would be applicable. However, if you are providing byproducts or sending them forward onto suppliers and farms that would in turn use it to produce animal feed, then no, section on animal feed would not be applicable, but that is covered under section 4.13.
All right, we have a question here, and I apologize in advance if I mispronounce this name, from Nagaraju. They are under the impression, they understand from 2021, is the unannounced audit requirement applicable to version 9? They wanted to know if that's correct.
Sorry, could you say that date again?
So let me read it verbatim. Is the unannounced audit requirement applied to V9? I understand it started from 2021. Is this correct?
Okay, yeah, there's a bit of history to this. And again, a great question. So essentially the requirement for unannounced audits, so this is the mandatory 1 in 3 unannounced audits every sort of 3-year period. So the requirement came in when the GFSI benchmark came out, that was the year 2020. The certification program owners do have up until a year to implement that requirement. Hence, what we did, considering we were in the peak COVID era at that point, we left it or just allowed the sites to have a year's grace. So where the requirement went live 2021, we gave the sites an additional grace of 2022, essentially. And the way we see it is end of 2022 is where the grace period went off. So in essence, from this year onwards, so that's version 9 onwards, you would have to undertake an unannounced audit. So that would be the mandatory requirement coming into effect, essentially, yes.
Okay. Hopefully that answers your question. If anyone has any follow-up questions, please do feel free to keep them coming. We're happy to answer as many as we have time for in the next about 12 minutes or so. It looks like we have a question from Felicia. Felicia asks, as a site, I had a late audit because of the pandemic. Can I wait until 6 months have passed from certificate validity to get the new cycle and escape the major finding for a late audit? Is there a clause or reference for this case?
What I would suggest is if you can get in touch with the certification body, because whatever I answer, you would have to, one, agree that with the CB, and essentially the CB would need to get in touch with BRCGS, as in our team, the compliance team, and work our way around it. So as I said, first of all, first point of contact, get in touch with the CB, ask them to raise it and have a discussion around it. But if they need to get in touch with BRCGS, then absolutely we will. Just to explain a little bit around that, so when it comes to conducting the audits, BRCGS does not get involved in when the audit's organized, how the audit's organized. We work very closely with our certification bodies, and they are the ones who have auditors and boots on ground, and they organize these audits. So essentially, if there's anything that is outside norm, they would need to agree that with us, as in BRCGS, and take it from there.
All right, thanks, Richa. Let's see, we've got a question here about allergen management. Is the section on allergen management applicable where there's no governing legislation about allergens in, say, pet food or animal feed?
Oh, again, a good question. So yes, the way this requirement works is if there is no governing legislation where in the countries where you're operating, so for pet food and animal feed, then essentially the answer could potentially be no. However, we know that a number of products are out there in the market where the suppliers are claiming pet food products to be gluten-free. So in case you are making an allergen-free claim on either of these product types, pet food and animal feed, then our advice would be, yes, section on allergen management is applicable. However, if you're not making those claims and you sit in a country where there's no governing legislation, then absolutely that section would not be applicable.
All right, thanks for the question there. All right, we've got a question here from Mukesh. Again, apologies if I mispronounce any names, about blended on unannounced audits. He's asking, can any site apply for blended unannounced audits every year?
Okay, so first of all, to clarify, we do not have a blended unannounced audit protocol worked out. If you are applying for the unannounced audits, then it's only on-site audits that happen. So you do not have the remote and on-site audit split that is available for unannounced audits. But if you are talking about blended announced audits, then sites can sign up to blended announced audits. However, when it comes to your turn of having the 1 in 3 mandatory unannounced audit, then that audit will revert to a fully on-site unannounced audit.
All right. Hopefully that answers your question, Mukesh. If it doesn't, please send a follow-up. We're happy to answer. We do have a question here that has just come in from Mario. Mario says, my business has a Global GAP certificate for more than 150 producers and also BRCGS food safety standard certification in our central plant. Could you explain a little bit more of the additional module 10 Global GAP and how we can unify these certifications? Is it the same as the addendum of FSMA?
Great question there. Thanks, Mario. So the way this additional module works, it is a little bit similar to FSMA, but a bit different. So with issue 9, we are in the process, and as I've already indicated, there's 3 additional modules that are published or about to be published. So the way the Global GAP works is, this is the Global GAP chain of custody. So in case you operate with the chain of custody module for your products, and this is namely fresh produce. So if there's fruits and vegetables that go through and they have the chain of custody certificate. So this additional module is primarily aimed at the chain of custody. So BRCGS standards, as you might know, we operate post farm gate. So what that means is farming is not included. Hence, global gap is not mandatory for our standard. But the second element of chain of custody, once it's left the farm, is what this additional module would entail. The way it works is very similar to FSMA. You'll have the audit the same day when you have your food safety audit, and it's additional sort of like an hour that gets added in. We are currently updating because Global Gap have updated their standard, not just the main one, but the chain of custody as well. So we are reflecting those changes in within our module, and it will be published shortly. But yeah, it works very similar to FSMA in regards to protocol. But it was just this element that it's not the farming elements that we cover within the additional module. It is the chain of custody elements that do get covered.
All right, great. Thank you. We're getting down to the bottom of the list of questions. If you do have any of those, please don't hesitate to send them in. Don't be shy. There is no such thing as a silly question. I'm sure Rich is happy to answer anything you might ask. We have a question here from Binny. They ask, is exception to supplier approval program applicable to high-risk suppliers due to the lack of GFSI certification or non-feasibility of supplier audits?
Very interesting question, but all I would say is potentially one that may need to be discussed with this certification body, and if required, a concession might be needed, because generally that is not the case. So although you can do risk assessments and you can potentially put the case forward, but most likely, yeah, I would need a further discussion.
All right, thanks, Richa. All right, and it looks like we are staring at our last question here. If anyone has any last questions about what was presented, if you have any questions about Pager FSI and, you know, scheduling audits with us or anything, we do still have Chris Reno on the line from our U.S. office. He's happy to answer questions about FSI specifically. All right, we've got another question here about blended audit options. If a site chooses the blended audit option, Richa, how does the requirement to have mandatory unannounced audits every 3 years work?
So again, it's as I said, we do not control this operation. This is all managed by the certification bodies as they manage the auditor pool. So we write the standard and CBs go out and audit against it. So this entire process of when you would have your unannounced audit would be managed by the CB. If you have blended audit, as I said, so you can have your blended audit for your announced options. But as soon as you are going to undertake the unannounced audit, then the CB would sort of needs to inform you within the 3 months following your previous audit. So as soon as your last audit is completed and within the 3 month window, they will let you know whether your next audit would be announced or unannounced. So that's how you find out. But when it comes to your unannounced audit, there's no blended unannounced option. So you would have to undertake a full unannounced audit on site.
All right, great. And as a follow-up to the previous question from Binny, Binny has said it's mayonnaise, egg-based, which comes under ambient high care production zone due to raw egg components, which may support pathogen growth. So I'm not sure if that would change the answer you gave, Richa.
No, as I said, it's essentially when it comes to, because again, Binny, what I would suggest is if you wouldn't mind forwarding the same question in entirety onto inquiries@brcgs.com, and let's pick it up there, because again, there might be a bit more of a discussion and questions that we might have to consider, and then we can follow it up and close that off accordingly.
All right, thank you for the follow-up, Binny. All right, we have a question here from Ahmad. How do I assess risk zone as a decision tree is not part of issue 9?
Okay, so very interesting question again, and I'll explain the reason for my giggle. So with issue 8, we did have decision trees included within appendix 2. Now, the decision trees were provided as an aid to the definition that existed for the production risk zones and how what is high risk, what is high care, what's ambient high care. So this was something to be used as an add-on, an addition to the definitions, but the prime purpose and the key focus for us was for the sites to utilize the definitions and design the risk zones accordingly. However, what we did see, and again, what was the way the question structured, it's highlighting the same challenge, if I can say, that the sites are relying on the decision trees a lot more than the definitions, which is definitely not the intention. Hence, the working group wanted to take the decision trees out from the appendix. So what that does is the sites do still have the definitions that they should have actually relied on in the first place. So definitions are what they should go by. Now, however, since the decision trees have been taken out, quite a few sites and quite a few standard users have asked this question: can they use the HOA decision trees, considering we don't have version 9? It's a strong no. Please do not use the decision trees for issue 8. What we are in the process of doing is we've updated the understanding guideline document, so which was called the understanding high risk, high care, ambient high care. It is due to be published shortly. It's gone through the editorial process. Once it is published, you would find another version of the decision trees. And they are sat in the appendix of the document. There is a decision tree that you can utilize. But as I said, because it sits in a guidance document, essentially it is just to aid and help support with the decision making. But those are not the ones that you should really rely on, because when the inquiries come in, sites do have a tendency to say, oh, based on the decision tree, the answer to this question was a yes or a no. And it becomes very tricky for us to understand what exactly the product type is. We don't really know your rationale behind whether a question was a yes or a no. So hence, what we are trying to do is really focus and really highlight the point. Please, you do utilize the definitions. But there is a version of decision trees that will be provided in the guidance document as and when it's published.
All right, great. Thank you for that question. I think we have time to squeeze in one more before we wrap things up. This one comes from Greg. Greg says, my waste product is sent for animal feed. Two products are made. One includes the addition of other ingredients. Would it be just the one product that would need to be included or in the animal feed section or both?
So if you are not manufacturing the product and you are sending the byproducts of your main operation to another site, so your products will act as an ingredient to the other site, then there's no need to comply with animal feed section. So your byproducts would be covered as they currently are within section 4.13. So if you are not manufacturing them on your site, if you're not manufacturing animal feed itself, it is an ingredient to another site that manufactures animal feed, no need to comply to animal feed. You are covered by 4.13.
All right, great. Thank you so much for that last question there, Greg. If anyone else has any other questions, I do encourage you to email BRCGS at the address on the screen. If you have any questions specific for FSI in the US or the UK, I would encourage you just to take a picture with your mobile phone of the screen as it is right now with all that contact information, just while we're waiting to get the slides uploaded for you all to download. Again, I'll encourage you, if you maybe missed part of the presentation today, or if you found part of it especially useful, feel free to go to our YouTube channel either later today or tomorrow. We should have the recording of the presentation uploaded, and you'll be able to share that freely with anyone you'd like from our YouTube channel. Richa, just as a last note, I'm so happy to have had you on. Great presentation. Thank you so much for all the thorough answers to the questions. Any last parting words before we wrap things up today?
All I would like to say is thank you to PGRFSI for having me on the session, and great audience here, amazing questions. Just one last thing, in case there's any questions that you do might want to send up as a follow-up, let us have a copy as well, because we are in the process of updating the FAQ document that does get updated after every issue update. So that again is another document we're currently working on. We can incorporate those inquiries, there's questions into the document, so it can be made publicly available and everyone can have sight of it. But yeah, all I would like to say is just thank you to the team. Great session today. Really enjoyed being here.
I absolutely agree. Thank you everyone so much for taking the time to join us today. Again, send those questions over and we will get you the answers that you need. Just wrapping things up, I hope everyone has a great rest of your day and have a safe and healthy rest of the week. We'll see you all next time.
Thanks, everyone. Take care. Have a great day.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Terry. Risha, as always, pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. As I said, it was absolutely incredible and really enjoyed the question and the session. Thank you.